Hey, welcome to Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. This weekend, we got a couple subjects to cover. One, I'm not sure how familiar people are with this deal, Dave, but it's the Wine Cup Ranch land transfer.
Yeah, the Wine Cup Gambles land. It's kind of, I guess it'd be called a transfer, but it's more of a consolidation. And
okay.
We can definitely get into that.
Yeah, that's going to eat up some time, and it's negative. I feel like we've focused on some of the negative stuff lately, but I don't know if it's us focusing on it or it's just there's so much coming out.
Yeah, and it is. It's kind of a negative for hunters and outdoors and recreationalists. It's more of just getting people aware of what is the potential here. You know, how it's going to affect anything recreational you want to do in the northeastern part of the state of Nevada.
Yeah.
It's a humongous piece of land. It's one of the largest ranches in the entire country.
And you know, it's funny, I've heard of the Wine Cup Ranch, but I would put myself squarely in that camp of an uninformed sportsman to some degree. I'm on all the email lists for stuff and everything, but this one has kind of flown under my radar. Anyway, we'll get into that. It'll
be one of those topics that we'll be bringing on the show multiple times over the next year or so. It's something you're not going to cover in an hour. You're not going to cover it in 3 hours. Some of the commission meetings on this have lasted a significant amount of time.
Okay. Well, anyway, we'll get into that.
We'll get into it.
First, though, I want to talk about muzzle loaders when we do our show prep stuff and bounce ideas off each other.
Yeah.
We kind of left everybody hanging on the muzzleloader thing. We went and got them.
Yep.
We've been out shooting them.
Yes.
Finally got you dialed. So
that was painful. And we got some great video of us doing it. So we got to get that all.
Yeah, we need to.
We got to get that all figured out and put on our social media. But it was a lot of fun.
Here's my takeaways. Right off the bat, the effective range of muzzleloaders.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if it's just the sights we have. Maybe somebody out there has some kind of super duper sight they're running. But these stories I've heard over the years of killing animals at 400 yards or so.
Yeah, killing a deer at 400 yards with their muzzleloader.
Maybe in one of these states where you can run a scope, but
not in Nevada.
I gotta be honest with you, I don't see how that could happen.
Unless that is an absolute luck shot.
And yeah.
I'm not putting anyone's abilities down, but with not being able to have a scope, you have to use iron sights, you know, or one of these Williams sights or other manufacturers. As we noticed, we threw some bullets out there at 200 yards.
Yeah.
And the sight, even the really nice, fine, cross-haired Williams.
That I've
the,
got,
the little
yeah.
app piece that you put in there, even at that distance, you're not only covering the target that's the size of a deer at 200 yards, you're covering 5 or 6 deer. I mean, it's like, it covers a lot.
Yeah. I went down the rabbit hole with, I have a ballistics calculator that I use for like long range shooting.
Yeah, I have a finger where I lick it and I stick
and
it in
stick
the air.
Stick it in the air, yeah, Kentucky windage.
Yeah.
So I was plugging in some numbers, like a rough estimate, and we'll get into the powder charge, the bullet, all the stuff we're using. But I was plugging numbers in and doing some calculations. At 400 yards, with our load, our bullet, and the ballistic coefficient of the bullet we're using, you're talking about like an almost 5-foot drop, and if there is even a lick of wind, you're talking about like feet
left
of
and right.
Drift.
Yeah.
So, and that's at 400. These are numbers like I would see at 1,200, 1,300 yards with a center fire rifle, and it's at 400. We also shot out to, I shot mine at 200.
Right.
And I was feet low
at
200.
Oh, yeah. You were hitting
way, way low.
You were hitting the dirt well in front of the target.
Yeah.
You had no idea.
No, I didn't.
I took 2 shots at the 200 yards, and I was like, I'm not even going to completely frustrate the bejesus out of myself by even attempting this. So it really gave me a completely different perspective on muzzle loaders.
Absolutely.
Now. You know, I love my archery. I've always done it. I think I'm going to start picking a few choices now with muzzleloader because the challenge. I mean,
yeah,
we're going to be out chasing antelope here in 2 days.
Yep.
And I bring in the muzzle loader.
Well, out finding antelope well, in two yeah, days. Yeah, your tag hunt, opens the 22nd.
Yeah, the tag opens the 22nd, but we're going to head out there earlier to go do our scouting and look around and find the one that we want to kind of chase. But
target.
The muzzle loader is going to be on our back. And
let's get it done.
It's going to be cool. But, you know, it was a lot of fun. Went out, three times. Spent a few hours each time out there at the Carson City Range, which I got to let everyone know, they did a fantastic job redoing that entire range.
Yeah, it is a nice facility.
It's a nice facility. It really is. And $5 a car, I mean, you can't beat it to go out there and tinker for 2 or 3 hours and frustrate yourself and, you know, want to go home and kick the dog or something. But
well, before we get into frustrations, let's go through the setup. Here's a couple takeaways, just broad overview stuff that I've learned so far. One, I'd say it's a 200 and in weapon system, at least with our capabilities. Two, the recoil. I'm not really adverse to recoil. You know, I've been shooting guns for a long time. Doesn't really bother me, but I will say, in that light 5.5-6 pound rifle or muzzle loader with 90 grains of powder and a 250 grain bullet in there, you know it when it goes off.
Oh,
I was a little taken aback by how much recoil there was.
Yeah.
And then the third takeaway is those Williams gun sights are worth every penny.
All day. And we don't have a dog in the fight here, man.
No.
We're not being sponsored. They didn't give us the sights.
Nope.
They
bought
them. Purchased. That was my game changer.
Yes.
Like, we'll talk about it here when we get into our shooting. But my God, when you said, Dave, grab my gun, because we have the identical guns.
Yes.
Except for
sights.
I've got the stock sights on there to test it. And you've got Williams. The Williams Western, because you can change out the apertures.
Yes, yeah.
So, major game changer. I mean, completely changed my patterns, and I finally was happy.
Yes, yeah. The way they come set up, you know, we were on paper at 100. It's okay. It's those two dots, two red fiber optic dots.
Yeah, the fiber optic dots.
Well, they're halfway down the barrel from the factory, and then you've got the one green dot at the very end of the barrel.
Yeah, which is like a 0.29 fiber optic.
It's a big sucker.
It's huge. So, at 100 yards, if you're in some good sunlight, that green dot with the two reds, with the sun bursting from the fiber optics, it covers everything.
I mean,
it's like a brick wall down there.
And people listening, if you've ever shot pistols, we'll say, there is that what they call the sight radius.
Yeah.
So, you know, on a pistol, a shorter, like a 4-inch barrel carrying concealed pistol, your sight radius is much shorter. It's inherently going to be less accurate than like a full blown race gun, like a Staccato or something that has this long 5-6 inch bull barrel and these long sight radiuses.
Or the Dirty Harry. Yeah.
You got, what was that, 44 mag?
44 mag with a 12-inch barrel.
You know, you got that longer sight radius. You're inherently more accurate with it. The thing that I noticed right off the bat is, what are they, like a 24-inch barrel?
26, I think.
26-inch barrel. 26. With that rear sight aperture, as they come from the factory to the front sight, you're talking about a 12-inch sight radius,
probably,
14?
Yeah, 12, 14 at the most.
Right. So inherently, that's going to be less accurate than like with the Williams, where you take off that mid-barrel rear aperture, you move it all the way back.
Yeah.
So now you've got a 26-inch sight radius.
Yeah.
You're inherently going to be more accurate.
Yeah.
So right off the bat, I noticed that. I thought, well, that's weird. Why'd they put it halfway down the barrel? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that was very odd for me, especially when maybe someone out there is going to be like, hey, dumbass, you can move it.
Yeah, maybe you can. I don't know.
And here we are. Like me, I was struggling because I had to jam my face into that butt so hard to be able to line myself up. It really became more of a pain in the butt. But then when I shot yours, I was like, oh, dude, this is magic.
Yeah, and the inherent accuracy benefits of having for both of us with the archery thing, we're so used to looking through a peep sight.
Yeah.
So with the Williams, it has that rear peep.
Yeah.
So it was that natural, like, okay, I line up the front globe, they call it, within that peep aperture, and then I center the fiber optic dot on the target. So it's just a much more intuitive and natural way to aim the gun.
Yeah, just once I looked through your gun, it was that comfort zone just kind of went through me like I was shooting my bow. You know, it just is like, I know how this works.
Yes.
For beneficial.
I would tell people, so if you plan on getting into muzzle loading like Dave and I would spring for the extra. They're not cheap. For like $120, just mentally add that into your budget, because I would not go back to the factory sights.
No, I'm picking that up right off the get-go.
And you're going to use mine for the antelope hunt.
Yeah, for the antelope hunt, because I shot it, I'm dialed in with it, you've already got it on there, so picked it up later. But, you know, it was a lot of fun doing that, and the cool thing was we picked so much stuff, and we'll get into this next segment.
Yeah, next segment we'll,
you know, so everyone knows, I mean, we had 3 different types of powder.
Yes.
We had 4 different types of bullets at different weights. We had 2 different 209 primers. We kind of mixed it up a bunch just to see about the gun's abilities and accuracies, and with Henry being very proficient with firearms and stuff, it was having his expertise there really helped out. You know, we'll get into this next segment, so.
Don't go anywhere. We will be back on Nevada Backcountry, and when we come back, we'll talk about our setups, we'll talk about the powders used, the bullets used, the primers used, etc. Don't go anywhere. If you're just joining us, the show is Nevada Backcountry. If you miss a segment of the show, you can always go to 991fmtalk.com. Click on the podcast tab. We are there. If you have an Apple iPhone, we are on Apple Podcasts. I've been working on getting it on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, but like everything in my life, it's chip away a little bit, and then I move on to the next project.
You'll get there.
Here's where we left off. You know, we talked about some of the takeaways from our entry into the muzzle loading world. I want to get into now the specific powders, bullets, primers we tested.
Yeah.
And we'll treat this kind of like a PSA. Hey, we might be able to save you a little bit of money if you're in that tinkering process with your muzzle loader. For powders, we got the Ultra Gucci Blackhorn 209.
Yep.
That Colton Rico from muzzle-loaders.com told us about. We got the Hodgdon 777 in FFG.
FFG, yeah.
Yeah, they make one in triple FG. We didn't get that one. We got the FFG. We got Pyrodex pellet, or no, not Pyrodex.
White Hots.
IMR White Hots. For bullets, we got the whatever the heck they are, the Hornady
ELD somethings, 340 grains bricks. Yeah.
Yep. Those were spendy. Those were like $17 for a dozen. And then we got the Hornady SSTs, the Hornady FTX bore drivers, and then an inexpensive option, I think they were a power built or something.
Yeah, they were just a power built,
240-ish grains.
It was 240 grains. It was like a,
I forget.
Yeah. It was a good bullet.
Yeah, it was not bad.
It was not a bad bullet in comparison.
And then we got the only 2 primers I could find were the Federal 209s.
Yeah, the 209As.
Muzzle loaders.
Yep.
And then we also got the Winchester 777 primers that apparently are specifically formulated for 777 powder. Let's start with powder, Dave.
Yeah.
What were some of your takeaways from the powders? And I should say propellants, because we did use those pellets, too.
So my first few shots were with the pellets, and I did 2 shots, and I went to do a 3rd shot, and I could not get the bullet pushed down the barrel.
It was so filthy.
I was luckily, I was able to pop the bullet out, and then I had to clean the gun. It seemed to shoot okay.
Yeah.
With the pellets, there is that caveat. They say, you know, if you push too hard on the bullet, you can crack a pellet, and then you're going to have an inconsistent burn.
Right.
And it's not going to do the same. So there's those concerns, because you don't know what the heck's going on down that barrel.
Right,
you don't know if it's other than that, it seemed okay, except for the headache of having to clean the gun
right.
and pull the plug every two shots. And I mean, when after two shots, that thing was so gummed up and filthy, it was like, okay, there's got to be a better process to this. And then I shot the black horn.
Yep.
That was really nice because it was clean. It burned really nice. We got like four shots out of that before we needed to clean them.
Well, I'll say, honestly, Dave, I probably could have gone longer.
Yeah.
I'll give Colton props on that because he told us it was like the cleanest burning yeah. powder. Yeah, there was a little bit of crunch, a little bit of stickiness after four or five shots.
Yeah,
but man,
but
you could have,
you could still get it down there.
Yes.
You know, you could still get it down. But we were trying to also be as accurate as possible because we were trying to dial the guns in.
Right.
And probably four or five shots, it might be affecting
the accuracy.
Performance of the bullet and the gun. Then the 777, I really, really liked that stuff. That actually ended up being
my favorite.
Yeah, the pick for both of us, actually. That was the one where we seemed to have our best groups.
Best groups, and it was right at about, now it was much dirtier than the Blackhorn 209.
Yeah.
But I would say safely, you could get four rounds before it's like, okay, I really got to clean this.
Yeah, agreed.
And here's the thing with that Blackhorn 209.
Yeah.
You can't find it.
No, and it's twice as expensive as this.
$88
Yeah.
For a bottle of it.
For a bottle of that. And the 777 was like
40 something.
Yeah, like 37 and some change.
Half the price.
It's half the price.
Yep.
And we both, after the process, we were like, this 777's for us, it's the way to go.
100%. Yeah. I mean,
if you're getting four shots off at an animal.
Well, that's the point, right?
That's the thing, right? It's like, good luck. I mean, that's got to be either the dumbest animal, it may be deaf and blind, if it's just going to stand there for you for four shots where you're trying to reload a muzzleloader.
So that was the pick, was the Hodgdon 777, and it's the FFG bullet-wise.
Yeah, well, primer.
Oh, primer.
I do got to say, the Winchester 777 primer actually had almost no blowback compared to the other primer we were using.
Federal 209MZ.
You know, when you pull the primer out, after you shoot, you pull the primer out, and the whole face of the primer was pretty dirty and gross. On the 777 one, it was still nice and shiny, so you didn't have the blowback. And that was one thing I read. Don't think I know this just because I know it. I actually read up on it, so that's how I know. But that's an important factor, too, especially when you're coming to having that proper, consistent ignition. That was the primer I would stick with.
And our groups were the best with it.
Yes.
With that powder and primer combo, as far as grains go, we ran everything as hot as 100.
And all the way down to 70.
You did shoot one with 70.
Yeah, without knowing it was 70, I thought it was a 90. And I
grabbed the wrong tube.
Where'd that go?
So we settled on 90
with
90 grains of the 777 powder, 777 primer. It's just dead on at 100.
Yeah.
Great groups.
Both of us. I mean,
that's where we landed.
You had incredible groups. Your shots were, you know, three shots were all within an inch of each other. I mean, mine were more than an inch.
Well, slightly, but yeah. No, I mean, you're good.
It was awesome. But yeah, and then the bullets, you started out with the big, heavy brick 340 grain
ELD X's, or something.
Yeah, something like that. And we shot a few of those. They were okay. They just didn't seem to have a consistency. I went all the way down to the cheap ones, and I just worked my way up. The two that I felt were the best were actually the inexpensive $9 for
Power Built things,
Power Built ones, and then the SSTs.
That's what we settled on. Yeah,
we both settled on that. That SST bullet, 240 grain SST,
250.
Was it 250?
250. Okay. Yep,
was the one. I mean that one.
I will say, so I don't want to take anything away from Blackhorn and the ELDXs,
right?
Because one of the best groups I shot was with that combo. But a couple things I want to bring up with those ELDX bullets. You have to have a special jag tip
on your plunger, the push
right,
it down.
Right, because it's such a narrow pointed projectile. So, man, if you're going to use those, it's like you got to have the special tip. They're twice the price of everything
else.
Yeah,
they were spendy. And
same with the blackhorn. So I'm like, yeah, okay, you can get really good groups, but one, you're not finding blackhorn, and two, it's expensive to go out and shoot. The sweet spot for us was 777, 777 primer, and the SST bullet. At 90 grains of powder. That's what you're going to be hunting with.
Yep.
Other than that, I mean, like I said, there's really no, I could nitpick a few things about some of the combos. I would say, look, if you have access to 209, money is no object, and you want to wring every last bit of accuracy out of a muzzleloader, man, that ELDX and 209 is not a bad combo.
No.
It's just, you know, again, you're not finding 209 in Winnemucca. It ain't happening. Or
yeah,
Elko.
Yeah. Or the bullets, because those weren't easy to come by.
No, they weren't.
They're tougher bullet to find. But, I mean, if you're looking to squeeze your accuracy in by another quarter inch or half inch or something, great. Spend the extra money and go for it. But just, I guess, stick with that because of some of those criteria. But
Like we talked about, right? It's the limitations of the sighting system.
Yeah.
But you're talking about open sights. At the end of the day, I would go more economical.
Yeah, and plus with that larger another 100 grain bullet, you start pushing it beyond 100 yards and your drop is just going to be exponential.
Oh, yeah, we saw that because when I shot at 200, I shot one of those.
Yeah.
And it was like 3.5 feet low.
It hit
the feet of my target stand.
Yeah, I mean, the hole it put in that thing was huge.
Yeah.
You stuck your thumb through that.
Yeah. Thing. Oh, the one thing I want to bring up is we have not seen terminal performance out of any of these. We haven't killed anything with these.
No.
We haven't shot them through ballistics, gelatin, or any of that stuff. So if anybody out there, if you've had real world experience on an animal with those Hornady SST muzzleloader bullets, by all means, text in. It's 775-884-9910 and let us know how it performed. I don't think we're going to have any issues with a copper jacketed bonded bullet like those SSTs.
No, I would hope not.
Hopefully, you know, within a week or so here, we get some real world experience to see how the bullet performs in an animal.
Last again is that Williams sight. I mean, that is an absolute game changer in regards to just building your confidence. For me, it was. That last day, boy, struggle bus had me in there big time. I mean,
I could tell you were starting to get
driving the bus.
Yeah.
I was really getting frustrated because I could not group diddly squat at 100 yards. And I'm like, we're leaving for a hunt here soon, and I can't shoot this gun. I just cannot figure out what I'm doing wrong, and you're trying to help me. And then finally you were just like, dude,
take my gun.
Try my gun. Try my gun. So I did, and pow. I mean, three shots right in
perfect.
There at the 100 yards. And I mean, you made a few little adjustments for me.
Other than that, I think that about covers it on muzzleloader stuff. When we come back, we're going to get into the controversial, I called it a land transfer. I don't know if there's a better way to say that.
And I think that's how they're phrasing it, is a land transfer. It's more of a consolidation, and we'll touch on that. But
it's time for us to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk wine cup ranch land transfer. Hey, thank you everybody for rejoining us on Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. I always say this and then we do it, but I hate to end on a negative note, Dave. We're going to get into this controversial wine cup land transfer all the way around. From where I'm sitting, this looks like a terrible deal for Nevada sportsmen or just people out recreating in the hills. Dave, you've been following this pretty closely. Give us the general overview of what this is, what the owner of the property is proposing.
Well, I've been following it. I don't know about how closely, so I'm going to leave that as a caveat there, just in case I really screw the pooch here. But so this is one of the largest ranches in the country. It encompasses just about 940,000 acres, 948,000 acres. The size itself, I mean, the land alone is 52 miles from north to south, 46 miles from east to west, and it covers somewhere in the range of like 1,482 square miles.
Whoa.
In the state of Nevada. It's the northeastern portion of the state, I-80 and up, like Wells,
right,
that area, Montello, pretty
yes.
much Montello,
yep.
the entire Montello area. So the land went up for sale in 2016, the entire ranch. I mean, the ranch goes back all the way to the 1800s, and it had multiple owners throughout those years. But 2016 and 2023, the fifth largest landowner in the entire country, Stan Kroenke, he owns the Los Angeles Rams and the Denver Nuggets and,
yep.
you know, billionaire guy. So what they're wanting to do, so the land isn't all just one huge, just one piece of land. There's a lot of those railroad squares, a lot of it's really
checkerboarded. Yeah.
Okay. The proposal is to consolidate that land by taking the public land, the BLM public land that is within the vicinity of the Wine Cup Gamble Ranch, and trading it for private land that the ranch has now, and then consolidating it to where they get rid of all the checkerboarding and then they just have one huge land mass
right.
as the ranch. The big issue that is coming there is access. Like, their proposal does not address any type of access for recreational use, hunting, camping, off-roading,
whatever
yeah. it is. The existing county and BLM roads, there's nothing about them still being able to be used. They don't really address it, and they don't want to address it. Another thing is, by consolidating that into one massive mega ranch, is there will be parts of hunting areas that you will possibly have to drive into Idaho and or Utah to come back
circle back around yeah.
to access your hunting land, if you even can, in some situations. So at this point in time, there's roughly 2 million acres of public land throughout the state of Nevada that is what we call landlocked. No one can
right.
access it
right.
because of private land ownership. I'm talking just the entire state. Roughly 2 million acres we can't get to.
I mean, the access issue is definitely going to be at the forefront, and that's going to be a nightmare. However, I want to bring up the quality of the land that they're proposing be consolidated or swapped or
yeah.
whatever. There's a survey. You've got the printouts right there. I printed them out earlier, too. In looking at that, I'm assuming this is from like biologist surveys. Wherever this data came from, essentially what they're proposing is BLM, or, you know, us public land owners, we get all these substandard from a biological or ecological
standpoint, yeah.
perspective. So substandard, overgrazed, mismanaged lands, and they get prime mule deer habitat, elk habitat, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So this is not a one-for-one swap quality-wise, and it's not a one-for-one swap
acreage-wise. Yeah. No, so in the proposal, their proposal is we will give you 1 acre of substandard land, and you will give us 2.5 acres of prime land. That's the difference. So with saying that, that will remove a net loss to Nevada residents and just recreationalists as a whole of roughly 140,000 acres
yeah.
of extra land will go to this ranch that we as recreationalists will not have access to. So just to reiterate that, the ranch will give the government 1 acre and the government will give the ranchers 2.5 acres. That's
yes.
the exchange.
Yes. Here's what I was going to say. I want to bring this up, because this is where I deviate from political party lines. I've heard Lars Larson talk about this before, about how much better land is managed when it's in private ownership, that the federal government shouldn't own land. Like it or not, as a sportsman, outdoor recreationalist in Nevada, we are tied to this public land. Okay, so fair enough that 140,000 extra acres that they get, maybe they will manage it a little better. But guess what? We're not going to have it. It's going to be gone. I would rather see that land managed by people like the Muley Fanatic Foundation or these conservation groups that do these habitat restoration projects, and then we're all allowed to enjoy it. And I know that's been the current push with right-leaning political figures is to get rid of some of this BLM or federally owned land, give it back to the states or sell it off. And like I said, this is where I may make some people mad, but I am absolutely against getting rid of federal public land, period.
I do agree with that because it does. When it does go into private ownership, it changes everything. They can do as they wish. Now, the Kroenke, K-R-O-E-N-K-E.
Kroenke, yeah. I believe is how you pronounce that.
So it's the Western Land Group and the Kroenke Ranches who own the wine cup. They can shut it down. You don't have any access. Now, the Wine Cup Gamble Ranch also has a portion of this enterprise is hunting. Every year they receive from 14 to 16 landowner bull tags,
right?
About 20 plus cow tags, and quite a few deer tags, as well as some antelope. And they sell those, and then they have a guide service, and then they take people out and hunt on their 900,000 acres of prime hunting property.
Land. Yeah.
The likelihood of them gaining another 140,000 acres and saying, yeah, sure, hunters, you guys can come out here too, is pretty, in my opinion, you know, this is just me, pretty unlikely if they're running a hunting business out of that property.
I'll be a little stronger about it. Okay, so look, for him, when he bought this place, it's a business transaction. He probably knew there was checkerboard stuff. He thought, hey, I make the right donations to the right candidates. I could get this passed, and now I've got this, and it increases the value of this property. You know, especially somebody like that, a billionaire, he's looking at this as a business transaction. He's not looking at this from an altruistic standpoint. He probably thought, hey, this place is undervalued. If I can get this passed, perfect. I'll make money. It's worth more money then.
Especially as a consolidated
ranch. Exactly. There's no way he's looking at this and going, well, I'm going to get an extra 140,000 acres of prime hunting habitat, but due to my good nature, I'm just going to let everybody hunt it. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah, you're right. These are business transactions for him. These are acquisitions.
Like, absolutely.
Like I stated, he is the fifth largest landowner in the United States.
Yes, I want to go further on that, Dave, but we're up against a break here. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get further into this, the way the process should work. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. I want to plug our show sponsors real quick, Battleborn Tree Service, Legacy Sports International, and Truck Envy here in Reno. Go support the people that support this show. Every one of those organizations has diehard hunters involved. So they are like you and I, and they've been good enough to step up and support this content. Before we went to break, Dave, you started going down how the process normally works with the NEPA, which is...
It's the Environmental Protection Agency.
Surveys.
Yeah, it's surveys, which the state of Nevada helps out with. It's a cooperative effort between federal and state agencies to follow very strict guidelines on surveys and gathering data in relation to many, many projects. I mean, we're talking anywhere from mining to solar, to wind, to everything that goes on in our state generally has to go through this NEPA process.
And what they're doing here is basically going straight to the Nevada state government.
The legislature.
The legislature. So they're trying to bypass that and get this deal done so they can consolidate.
Yeah. Just like anything, like any business, you don't want to wait 7 to 10 years to acquire results because it's not a cheap process, and it's not flipped by taxpayers. It costs the proponent a significant amount of money.
Okay.
So this isn't just a free bag of popcorn or something.
I don't want the last segment or this segment to come across as billionaire bashing. The guy did good for himself, good for him.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, it's just not a good proposal for Nevada sportsmen.
And not only Nevada sportsmen, but the Elko County in general. I mean,
right.
Hunting and recreating in that particular county generates over $9.3 million annually for Elko and the surrounding communities. That gets taken away or decreased significantly, and you can see some major, major impacts to some of the smaller towns in the area that rely on those particular seasonal upswings in their economy, you know,
yeah.
Hotels, restaurants, gas, you know, all that other stuff. You're talking Wells and Jackpot and Montello could be completely decimated with something like this, Elko itself. So it has a much broader potential effect.
This is going to the state legislature.
Yeah, 2025.
2025.
Yeah, it was supposed to be 24, and the ranch pushed it back to 2025 to gather more information and get some more of their ducks in a row, which is a great thing. I mean, they're going to run it out to stakeholders.
So does the CAB have any input?
Yeah.
They do.
The Elko CAB has been very active. The Elko County Advisory Board has been very active in this. This has gone in front of the Wildlife Commission, which opposes it. The CABs oppose it. Backcountry. Hunters and anglers.
BHA, yeah.
They oppose it. There's a significant amount of individuals and organizations that absolutely oppose this land transfer because of not just access, but even the effects on the ecosystem that it can have. There's parts of this that they're proposing with that much land of solar complexes. You know, like you said, he's a businessman. That's going to generate money instead of just having land sitting out there.
Where we see
something incredibly beautiful and awesome. They're like, well, I'm not making any money on the dirt. Let's cover it in solar panels. There's that kind of stuff in the future plans. And
how does this work with this? It's Commission Policy 64. Is it going to be like a hearing period where then the legislature votes on it? Legally, is there any process to slow roll this, or do you know?
Yeah, I mean, your best bet is to contact your congressman and say your piece. There's plenty of websites that you can get on to say your piece about it, if you're for it, if you're against it, what have you.
In reading some of this stuff, the input on land sales, transfers, and exchanges, and here's how I got this information. I just Googled, in fact, I think it was verbatim, Wine Cup Ranch Land Transfer.
Yeah.
And it brought me to a link for this stuff that I'm reading.
Yeah, and there's tons of links. I mean, yes. It takes you to you have a lot of information in front of you once you do that.
What would it be? It's like item 4 on that list. All land transactions must be in the public interest from a wildlife habitat protection and wildlife use standpoint. You know, how are they going to push this through when I don't see anything about it that's in the public interest?
Good question. That I don't know. How they can push a lot of this through with a lot of the data that's out there and some of these regulations that are out there.
Go down the list and even like item 2. Land exchanges should be supported only when the wildlife values on selected lands are equal to or greater than those wildlife values or potential wildlife values on offered lands. Based on the surveys, what we're getting is it sounds like just barren, useless land. I look at this stuff and I go, okay, yeah, there's no way in heck this is going to happen. But obviously, if it's making it to this point where we're talking about it, it's going before the legislature. Somehow they figured out a workaround, or they're playing that card. And like I said, I'll call him out on this because this is where he and I radically differ. Lars Larson is a constant promoter of privatizing public lands.
Yes.
And it makes me a crazy person. I beg to differ.
I'm with you completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
It's a bad deal all the way around. I'm going to go through the actual acreage real quick before we end the show so people know exactly what is at stake and what is being proposed. As it stands right now, this Wine Cup Ranch is proposing that they get 72,425 acres of what has been deemed good condition shrubland and 78,959 acres of what they're calling good condition grassland. What we would get in return is 28,788 acres of quote-unquote good condition shrubland, 29,895 acres of intermediate condition grassland, and then a smattering of what they label as juniper low to mid cover, poor condition grassland, and intermediate condition shrubland. That's what's at stake, is losing essentially prime wildlife habitat and feeding areas for what seems like kind of garbage.
Yeah, at a two and a half to one.
Exactly.
Yeah. A question I've been asking myself is like, what is the benefit of the consolidation?
I know exactly what they're going to play.
I can see the benefit to the ranch itself. It would be easier to manage because now you don't have to deal with having chunks of land that you surround, having to deal with that and go around them and fenced off. And, you know, all of the complications that come with having a whole bunch of different landowners benefits them. But how does this consolidation benefit the residents and the actual owners of this land that they want to take from us?
The card they play is the typical financial card. What they're going to do is they're going to say, hey, taxpayers in the state, you know, you guys pay X amount of dollars to manage fire suppression, federal government, you know, this is how much this land is costing you. Look, we'll take care of that for you. And especially when you have, 20 some odd trillion dollars in debt, the federal government would love to get rid of some of this stuff and say, hey, okay, look, we're decreasing debt. It's almost like bait and switch, right?
Yeah.
If a fire breaks out on this, Stan Kroenke's private firefighters are not going to go and fight this thing. We are going to pay to fight the fires on it. They'll get all sorts of tax subsidies for managing the land.
Rehabbing it.
Exactly. That's the talking point, is let's take this off your plate and we'll manage it for you.
You're talking 140,000 acres, which is a humongous piece of land. There's a lot of questions. You know, they're being asked, but they're not being addressed.
Agreed. And we'll make sure we get all of that out to the listeners. Everybody, enjoy your Sunday. Good luck out there if you have a tag in your pocket. And stay tuned for Tom Gresham coming up next.